Hi, everybody. Steve Savitsky. Welcome back to Savitsky Talks. And today I have Dr. John Loyke, who wrote a very interesting article in the Jewish Action, The Future of Reproductive Medicine, A Cross-Cultural Perspective. How are you, Dr. Loyke, today?
I'm fine.
Well, that's really great. So you wrote the article with four other people, Dr. Moshe Tendler and Rabbi Lam and Ira Bedzel.
No, Rabbi Flaum.
Rabbi Flaum, I'm sorry, right, Rabbi Tzvi Flaum, Rabbi Moshe Tendler, Rabbi Dr. Moshe Tendler, and Ira Bedzel. Very interesting. So I read the article, and of course I had to read it three or four times to understand it. So hopefully the other people are a lot smarter than I am, and they're going to read this, and it's going to make sense to them right away. But it is truly, truly fascinating what's going on in the world of medicine and genetics and so on and so forth. So from your perspective, first of all, maybe tell the listening audience a little bit about who you are and your background so they understand it.
Okay, I am on faculty at Columbia University Medical Center. I do research, biomedical research, in inflammation and genetics. And I also spend a lot of time writing and analyzing bioethical issues from both a secular and halachic perspective. And with the halachic perspective, I've written about 15 articles with Rabbi Tendler. YU's coming out with a book summarizing all those articles. And it's been a very interesting and challenging endeavor. The reason I got involved in the bioethical aspect is because I felt it was my social responsibility to provide some of the scientific and medical background that a lot of people, including rabbis, just don't know and don't have an understanding of where it's heading. And I think, as we all know, making decisions in halacha is not an immediate response. It takes time, and people have to think about this and have to really understand the basic science before they can make any halachic decision. So I try to provide the scientific background and bring in Rabbi Tendler to provide some of the halachic background to enable other rabbanim across the globe to understand these issues.
Mm-hmm. So you're kind of the go-to scientific person who they turn to, because obviously, I would imagine, very few rabbis have any of the science background that they need to make these
decisions. That's correct. And that's really, I think, part of the challenges that we as an Orthodox community face is how can we educate the Rabbanim to really understand all the details and implications of all these new technologies. They're constantly evolving, they're changing on a monthly basis, and they have real ramifications, practical ramifications in terms of their applications to our community.
And are there actually Orthodox rabbis who are doing this in a void without having the consultation with people like you?
I don't know how to answer that. I read what other people write, other rabbis write, and sometimes I am a little concerned that they don't understand the full science behind it. But as I said, the rabbanim are very smart, and they have their own resources. Sometimes I'm not sure if their resources are just physicians or a real scientist to really know what's going on. It's very hard to assess that. I know that when I meet with Rabbi Tendler, we really always go over the science in great detail before he thinks about the issues that relate to the halacha.
You would imagine. I'm saying you would imagine, yeah, Rabbi Flaum also, where Rabbi Flaum is very well known for this, dealing in this issue. And I know that,
right,
once again, as a serious person, Rabbi Flaum, who's a respected Talmud Chacham, definitely, because I've had conversations with him, and will always consult with, medical experts and science experts, because they just give him the guidance he needs.
Right. Right.
Now, when you look at this thing, when you read the articles and you see all the things that are going on, let's talk a little bit about some of the new technology, because reading that in the article, it really is just amazing, some of the new technologies that are going on. So maybe we could talk about one or two of the new things that are going on so people can understand.
I think that what really excites me is the derivation of cloning technology. In 1997, Dolly was cloned. That was the first sheep that was cloned using a technology. And it took almost 14 years, 15 years, until that technology, we could see a real application of that technology, not in cloning people, per se, because that's not what it's a real application should be, but in really helping people who have medical conditions. So as I mentioned in the article, one of these situations is mitochondrial mutations. In every person, there's a genetic material comes from two sources of a cell, a nucleus and another little organelle called the mitochondria. The mitochondrial genetic information comprises less than 0.1% of the total DNA. But women who have mutations in their DNA, in the mitochondrial DNA, can have severe neurological or muscular dystrophy-like symptoms. Mm-hmm. And all of your mitochondria, whether you're male or female, come from your mother. So that if a woman either inherited or gets a mutation in her mitochondria, all the children will be affected. And up until a few years ago, there's no way to cure that. And now with this new cloning type of technology, we can now take that woman and have her have healthy children. And we do this with what's called mitochondrial replacement therapy. We basically do a procedure where we give her healthy mitochondria. Mm-hmm. And we get that healthy mitochondria from another woman who donates the mitochondrial DNA to her, to mm-hmm. her egg, basically. So, in fact, what we're doing, and this is where the halakhic challenge comes really huge, is we're creating an embryo from three genetic parents, from the mother, the father, and the mitochondrial donor. Mm-hmm. And this is what halakha has to deal with, because halakha, up until this point, has, you know, really focused on a two-parent.
Right, of course. So the mitochondrial donor, from a halakhic point of view,
this person has to be
Jewish, or how does that
work?
Well,
that's the whole point. It's coming from the mother. These are the halakhic issues. Now, you can have different approaches, and this is where there's no real consensus as yet. You can say, well, maybe she's only giving such a small amount of DNA that, or genetic information, that it should not be included in the halakhic decision. On the other hand, it could be davar mamid. It's such an important aspect of the health of the embryo that without that you'll never get a healthy embryo, that it should be considered. So there are different approaches, and if it's considered, you have two. If one mother is not Jewish, what do you do? If the donor of the mitochondria is not Jewish, what do you do? And I mean, it creates a lot of interesting and dynamic halakha questions.
And today, as we stand right now, is there any kind of consensus on this?
No.
Or is it still no, there's not.
No, and there has to be, because women in Europe are using this technology to, women with these mutations are using this technology to have healthy babies, and eventually it's going to hit the Orthodox community.
Sure, of course, because I mean, if you think of about a rabbi speaking to somebody, and someone's getting married, and they come to the rabbi, and you could just picture the scene where the rabbi, oh, sure, I know your mother, I know your father, I know the whole family. And not asking, by the way, tell me, did your parents ever have any problems having children, and did they have to go through, fertility, and what else did they do, et cetera, in vitro? And, these are questions I guess rabbi's going to have to ask now.
And to make it even more interesting, which I did not write in the article because it just came out a few weeks ago, one can transfer mitochondria from younger women into the eggs of older women and improve the fertility of their oocytes. So you take a woman who's 40, where the fertility, her eggs are not as fertile as when she was 20, and she's having problems. If you do this mitochondrial transfer from a younger woman, her oocytes become much more fertile.
Hmm.
Not only that, but in mice, when they've done this in mice, and they're doing this in women now, I don't know what the results are going to be, but they're starting to do the clinical trials in women. But in mice, the mice that have these cross, the mitochondrial and nuclear DNA from different donors are healthier, live longer, have lower cholesterol, and seem to be much healthier breed. Now, will this apply? And they live longer. So Would this work in humans? I don't know, but it's certainly something to consider that you could use this not just for a woman who has a mitochondrial mutation, but for anybody who wants to have healthier, long-living children.
So you go and you find a real healthy person, and then...
You find a young woman who's willing to donate the mitochondria, and you do it.
Now, so is it a very involved procedure, or
it's not that involved. It's pretty straightforward. It's expensive. It's not going to go down. It's going to be $25,000 to $50,000 to do this.
Really?
Yeah. But it's basically what you do is basically you have to hormonally stimulate the woman who's a donor. You obtain her eggs. You remove the nuclear material and retain the mitochondria, and then you do what's called nuclear transfer. You take the woman who wants to receive the mitochondria, take her nucleus and put it in that egg, and you have it done and reimplanted into the woman.
Wow. Now, they're doing this already, correct?
I'm sorry? In England, yeah. They have, I think, nine or ten women who are pregnant with this, and I think one or two have given birth. I'm not sure. It's hard to know.
So far in the States, we haven't had this at all.
No, but Colombia is probably taking the lead positions and is now going to create embryos and look at the embryos this way, and then hopefully in the next few years, we'll get approval to begin to do this in clinical studies.
So as man begins to play God, you as a Orthodox Jew, Torah Jew, how do you react? Does it strengthen your emuna, or what does it do?
It obviously strengthens it. It's interesting you say that, because one of the major objections in the secular world is you're playing God. You're tampering with the Holy Grail, the DNA. And in contrast, I am a firm supporter of the Ramban, who believes that human beings are partners in the creation process. The world is not created complete. It was created, that's why we do Mila on the baby. We engage to improve the world. So any technology that we can incorporate and learn about and explore that's already existing is just enhancing our role as a partner in the creation process of the Kodesh Baruch Hu.
So that's great. Now, this is an important question, because I know that people are going to ask that question, because it's so hard, in a way, to find emuna. It really is. It's one of the most difficult challenges in the world. And here you are, a renowned scientist, a very dedicated Orthodox Torah Jew, and it's important for people out there to hear what you have to say about this, because sometimes some people are just going to say, forget it. It just doesn't make any sense. But I know it's really everything that you do, you see the hand of Hashem in what's going on.
Every day, when I look under the microscope and I see the cell, and I see it divide, and I see it functioning, and I try to understand the complexities of how a little cell works, it's so complicated. One cannot help but believe in Kodesh Baruch Hu. It's like Avraham looking at the stars, and he sees Kodesh Baruch Hu. I look under the microscope, and I see Kodesh Baruch Hu. Same thing.
Wow. That's really, really beautiful, and probably such an important message for people to hear, because, we don't even know where this is going. I mean, I certainly don't, because I'm a layman, but even you as a scientist, I mean, I know you could conjecture and think about it, but who knows where this is going to be in 10 to 15 years, right?
Right. That's very exciting, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. It's just the tip of the iceberg what's happening in science and how that's going to impact everything. But what I think the other message that the article really says is that halacha has really defined guidelines, and that's very important. So let's take, for example, in vitro fertilization. In vitro fertilization requires specific steps, procedures, hormonal stimulation. You have to give injections. You have to retrieve the eggs. You have to reassess the condition of the eggs and reimplant. They're all on a very scheduled procedure. And when you think about it, you say, of course, many Rabbanim feel that infertility is a halachic disease. Defined disease, and that one can, forego certain halachot like Shabbat and Yom Tov to allow the woman to become fertile. and that is accepted by many rabbanim. However, one has to consider that science has gotten to the point where we're so exact on the scheduling that we can schedule all these procedures so a woman does not have to go into the hospital or do these procedures on Shabbat.
Great point.
So that one has to really, if a woman, if an Orthodox woman wants to undergo these, needs to undergo these procedures, they have to go to a gynecologist or an infertility doctor who understands the halachot and can really schedule all her, you know, procedures. She doesn't have to go in on Yom Tov and on Shabbos. And as you know, the organizations who will pay for hotel rooms and for going in for Shabbat and do all that stuff. And it's a big chesed, but it may not be as necessary as they think. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, if there are problems during one of the procedures, she has to go in there. Of course, she'll go. Of course, many rabbis will allow her to go. But I'm saying there are ways to circumvent that.
Now, have you ever spoken to any of these organizations about this? I presume
not yet.
Okay. Okay. Listen, you know, this is what happens sometimes in the Orthodox Jewish world. We are such balei chasadim. We're always trying to do what's right and correct, and we really are, I think, you know, really light unto the nation when it comes to chesed. But you're right, sometimes you have to look at it and say, well, maybe these things are really not that necessary. And, you know, when you look at it, I mean, I certainly hope that as this continues, you know, we're going to find a way of getting one central group of Rabbanim together with scientists so that we have some, you know, unanimous ideas about how this is going to work. Otherwise, it's going to be so convoluted and so difficult that you could imagine what it's going to be like in the next generation.
Right. I'm involved in such a group at YU. They're putting Rabbanim together with scientists and OBGYN specialists to try to address a lot of these issues. So it's just the beginning stages of this, to educate the Rabbanim, to make sure they understand the science, and to see if they can come up with some sort of a guidelines and consensus.
Right. And you know, I was always thinking about, wouldn't it be interesting if we actually, like, the halacha could kind of guide the system as opposed to the system guiding the halacha?
Well,
that would
be fascinating, wouldn't it? I think that halacha is very well established for these type of procedures and methodologies. I think it's impressive. I remember that when Avram Steinberg first asked Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach the question of gestational surrogacy, the question where you have a couple who, let's say the woman is born without a uterus, so she cannot carry a child. So she recruits another woman to carry the child with her egg and her husband's sperm. So he asked Rav Shlomo, supposing the woman is not Jewish, what is the status? So the gestational mother is not Jewish, and the genetic mother is Jewish. And Rav Moshe said to him, says, this is amazing. This is one of the first times I've heard of a medical case where there's no halachic precedent. Mm-hmm. But halacha is so precise that we know how to handle that. And in such a situation where there is no precedent, we call a chumrah. Both have to be Jewish. If they can't be Jewish, then we have to convert the baby. So the procedures in halacha are very well outlined and detailed to allow any Rav who understands it to come to a conclusion. And that's the beauty of Gemara. That's the beauty of halacha.
It's really beautiful. Listen, Dr. Luki, we can go on and on and on. This is truly, truly fascinating. I know people are going to read the article, and they're going to really, really enjoy it, and hopefully they'll be a lot smarter than I am, so they don't have to read it two or three times. But I've enjoyed the conversation, and you're really on the cutting edge. It's unbelievable. It must be exciting for you, being at the cutting edge of this technology, and from the halachic point of view, really helping shape, you know, where we're going in Klal Yisrael, and hatzlacha to you and everything you do. And
Thank you.
Obviously, you know, people listening don't know the whole family, but trust me, the Loiki family and the forefront of what's going on in Jewish life. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Have a wonderful, wonderful day. Bye-bye. Be well.
Bye-bye.